Okay, everybody, welcome back, and thank you all for being here again. It's a real pleasure to introduce a former colleague and head of the English department here at Maynooth, and also on a personal level, Chris has been a really kind mentor, so it's a real pleasure to welcome him back here. Chris became the inaugural Seamus Heaney Professor of Irish Writing at Trinity in 2014. Everyone who knows Chris will be familiar with his range of work in Irish studies. His expertise ranges from the literature of the famine to media studies and to an extensive expertise in Irish theatre. Among Chris's major publications are History of the Media in Ireland, which I glibly remember him telling me. I said, what does that cover? And he said, well, from the beginning right up till now. So it really was a major publication. The award-winning A History of Irish Theatre, again, quite wide-ranging from 1601 to 2000, and writing The Irish Famine, which all of you here will know. His most recent book, co-authored with Sean Richards, is Mapping Irish Theatre, Theories of Space and Place. And among his many edited books relevant for us here today are The Hungry Voice, Poetry of the Irish Famine, and Fearful Realities, New Perspectives on the Irish Famine, and the Oxford Handbook, just in case you thought Chris was beginning to slack off after his move to Trinity. The Oxford Handbook of Modern Irish Theatre, co-edited with Nikki Green, is just about to be published. I believe it already has. It's been there.
The final proofs.
Okay, so it's just about to be published. Chris is a much-in-demand speaker around the world, having just arrived back in from New York last week, and we're delighted to welcome him back and that he has made the time to be with us here. So please help me welcome Chris Morris.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Una, for that generous introduction. Being back here in Maynooth, I feel it's uncanny. I feel like a bit of a revenant. As Una said, I mean, actually the week before last, I was in New York doing some talks, and I had an afternoon off, so I hadn't been to the top of the new World Trade Center, World Trade Center 1, which just opened to the public last May. So having an afternoon free, I decided, as you do, I was going to go down and have a look at it, because I'm a sucker for tall buildings and, you know, what you can see from the top of them. So I went to the top, and I do the thing that you do. You look out, and okay, there's Brooklyn, there's Staten Island, there's New Jersey. And then I looked down. And what I want to talk about this afternoon is what I saw from the top of World Trade Center 1. I looked down, and what I was looking directly into was Brian Toll's Hunger Memorial from 2002, basically, which looks more like that when you're not looking at it from 1,776 feet in the air. This is the Hunger Memorial in New York. And it occurred to me that looking at the Hunger Memorial from this particular perspective, looking at it from the top of World Trade Center 1, was a way of putting into focus some questions about famine art in particular, but particularly visual famine art that I have been trying to kind of focus for a while. And the key idea that I suppose I've been trying to work through with this is the idea of the event. And I'll come back to Zizek in a second here, but I've been trying to think about the event in particularly in terms in which Heidegger writes about the event in some of his late work. That word that's translated as event also means concern, care, where he talks about the event as that which allows us to understand the contingency of being and the way in which being can think itself, Dasein. Now, before I go down the Heideggerian rabbit hole here, I just wanted to say that this idea of the event has a longer history. It predates Heidegger, and it has had a particular focus in recent years. But there are two kind of main features of the event, if you like. That, first of all, the event is, as Zizek really summarizes it quite succinctly here, that the event is not something that occurs within the world, although it involves the world, but he says it's a change in the very frame through which we perceive the world and engage with it. And while Zizek mentions Heidegger in this book, Event, this is a very Heideggerian formulation, that the very possibility of thought is changed, is conditioned by these things we can call events. Now, the other characteristic of the event which led me to start thinking about it in terms of famine art, particularly visual famine art, is that the event itself has a certain elusiveness, if you like. Lyotard writes about the event in The Inhuman, where he talks about in the event, he says, we have the ungraspable, the undeniable presence of something which is often other than mind, and yet which, from time to time, occurs. Now, it seems to me, if we go back over the history of thinking and writing about the famine and representations of the famine and famine art, going back, say, to the early 1990s, that there are two major figures, there are two major arguments that control a lot of the narrative, and I would have been involved in some of these myself. The first is the idea of the famine as event, in precisely that sense that there is a before and an after. When Zizek writes about the event, he says, for instance, for him, say the two big events in Western history are the fall and the Enlightenment. So we can talk about pre- and post-Enlightenment. If we're talking about a Catholic teleology, we talk about pre- and post-fall. Or that we think of, say, the crucifixion as this point, as an event through which we can date pre- and post to the point at which we can actually date history, AD, BC. So the famine constitutes an event in Irish history in precisely these terms. And we need only think of F.S.L. Lyons' masterful book from 1971, Ireland Since the Famine, that it's been one of the dominant ways in which Irish history has been configured, has been in terms of the event of the famine. I think one of the most, or not the most, but one of the really overlooked books of writing about the famine has been Stuart MacLean's The Event and Its Terrors, where he actually takes on this idea of the event. And at one point, for instance, he quotes Sir William Wilde, here with a marvelous beard, where Wilde is in turn quoting an informant, if you like, that he has. This is from Wilde's Irish Popular Superstitions, where Wilde is quoting this old man that he meets in Connaught, who's telling him about folklore. And the old man says to him, the good people are leaving us fast. Nobody ever hears now the tick-tack of the leprechaun. Sure, the children wouldn't know anything about the puka. The warning voice of the banshee is mute, for there are few of the rare old stock to mourn now. The sheog and the thivish are every year becoming scarcer. This idea that the famine constitutes an event after which the supernatural evacuates the Irish landscape. In other words, the famine constitutes, if you like, the event which inaugurates Irish modernity, that a haunted landscape, a landscape that is peopled by these figures, the puka, the leprechaun, and so on, disappears as a result of the famine. What MacLean is doing is, from an anthropologist's point of view, he's questioning this and saying, well, perhaps we need to think about other ways of knowing, other ways of writing history, other ways of thinking about history that actually, you know, act as if the leprechauns were still out there, you know, that we don't treat this as a kind of turning point. And this idea of, if you like, multiple temporalities continuing on in Irish history after the event is something that I think has become, you know, one of the really interesting arguments in Irish cultural history more generally. And I'm thinking here particularly, say, Luke Gibbon's book on Joyce's Ghosts, which appeared, you know, a month or so ago now, and particularly the chapter in that on time, is dealing precisely with these kind of multiple temporalities and how what we can call the pre-modern continues to inhabit and haunt in some ways the modern. But even to use those terms, pre-modern and modern, implies the event, that moment of rupture, the before and the after. What I saw from the top of World Trade Center 1 was something that made me think about the event in a different way, because being up there and looking down at the famine garden, you were conscious of the frame as much as you were of the event. And that's what I want to try and think about for the next little bit, is the relationship between the frame and the event in how we think about visual culture in relation to the famine. Well, before I think about visual culture, I want to think about
audio or sound and how sound might make us think about the famine. Over the last couple of months, a group of electroacoustic music producers called The Housemaid and the Fear have been working on an album of songs that deal with hunger and lack and loss. And they're working on a track that is about the famine. And they got in touch with me, it was back before Christmas. And so we've had this kind of extended email correspondence about how you would actually use music to deal with the famine. I won't say represent. So the mix you're about to hear was done at 12:30 last night. This group, there's three of them as far as I can gather. We have this curious correspondence where I don't actually know their real names, and I've kept it that way. It's kind of interesting. But I know one is Irish, one's Scottish, and one's Finnish. So they did this mix last night, which is called the Professor Morash Crow Edit. The Professor Morash part's probably self-evident. The crow bit you'll hear in a second. I want you to bear with me on this, because I want to listen to this in its entirety as a way of thinking about famine art as a kind of, if you like, event and how it allows us to think the event. It's, I think, 7.5 minutes, so bear with me.
Her lips were cracked and swollen pink-white from the nettles. Her teeth were stained green from the grass and chipped in places from the pebbles she sucked against the hunger. Her belly was swelled from days of emptiness. I watched her struggle with the door, but she was so weak the wood gave less of a sound than if it were under a breeze. Her lips were cracked and swollen pink-white from the nettles. Her teeth were stained green from the grass and chipped in places from the pebbles she sucked against the hunger. The sounds were barely human and barely there. Accidental hisses of air, for anything else would have caused precious strength. I spoke, but she did not hear me. Ragged nails shuffled against the wood. And if she'd even half the strength, it would have been a long whine of need. As it came, clumped with phlegm, it was the breeze of wet despair. True bulrushes would have clear start or end. Her lips were cracked and swollen pink-white from the nettles. Her teeth were stained green from the grass. Her belly swelled from days of emptiness. I did not have the heart to tell her there was no food beyond, nor the will to approach her for some reason in return. I tried the names of my wife, my daughters, my sisters, mothers and hers. I tried those of my friends and theirs. They were all lost, neath the silent roaring of the hunger. Her lips were cracked and swollen and white from the nettles. Her teeth were stained green from the grass and chipped in places from the pebbles she sucked against the hunger. Her companion lay rigid by the wheel of the trap. A spilt sack of turf is last pushed to apoplexy. He must have found the sand soap I kept neat to see as it clotted bone-rigid fingers and its tin laying here, licked clean of its contents. Her lips were cracked and swollen pink-white from the nettles. Her teeth were stained green from the grass. Whether he lived, I did not check, for I feared he had seen far worse things than that. With his thick arms stuck like bishop's crooks to heaven, he bore such little weight, and his skin was so stretched as to give him the look of a scarecrow that had burst its sticks should you attempt to move it. Her teeth were stained green from the grass. Her teeth were stained green from the grass. had the walking grave by the shed, with not a strip of fat to clothe her. When the wind changed, her teeth chattered loud as though they were wood on glass. It was only this that put a stop to her hands mewling at the wood as she sought and retrieved a favorite pebble from her rags. This she mouthed and began to suck and clack about her opening and closing mouth like the most touched of the dumb. Her lips were cracked. Her lips were cracked and swollen pink white from the nettle. Her teeth were stained green from the grass, chipped in places from the pebbles she sucked against the hunger. Her belly swelled from days of emptiness. For fear of the fever, I got as close as I dared, but was sent away by the particularly fetid smell of mice. I thought to raise my voice, to try shoo her. Defeated, I slipped away and sought keys through the shed's other side. Upon returning, I met the clan, huddled quiet by the inglenook. Before the questions came, I found myself nodding, nodding, nodding. Her lips, her belly. Her lips, her belly. Her lips, her belly. Upon reaching the door, there was no sound of her, and I wondered if she'd gone away. Her lips, her teeth, her belly. I opened it to find her rigid, an outstretched hand grasping the frame hard in the agony of dying. Close as I could stand against the fetid and the mice, I got a good look at her then. I can tell her eyes and cheeks and marks. Her lips were cracked and swollen pink white from the nettles. Her teeth were stained green from the grass, chipped in places from the pebbles she sucked against the hunger. Her belly was swelled from days of emptiness. Her teeth were stained green from the ground. Her teeth were stained green from the ground.
You kind of have to listen to all of that. I mean, it takes the full 7.5 minutes, because what the piece is about is that moment towards the end where that relentless heartbeat, that kind of electronic heartbeat that is pounding throughout the piece, stops. Because I think one of what this does, and the reason I wanted to use this, is that if we're thinking about the famine as event, in this sense in which I'm talking about the event, that what we always have to acknowledge with the famine is that what we're talking about at some level is death. Death as the point beyond which we cannot think. And that's, in some ways, what makes the famine an event. Insofar is that it's about death on such a massive scale. It is the point beyond which you can't think. So therefore, you have to change the frame, change the paradigm, change the way you think. And it's the difficulty in famine art, the thing that gives so much famine art, raises this question in famine art of unrepresentable nature of the famine, is precisely this moment of death. And this, when I was
talking with the people working on this, I was saying, this is the thing you have to try and work on. How do we capture that? And they were trying to find, if you like, an audio way of capturing that moment at which things stop, things change, the capturing the limit, if you like, of thinking the limit of what is possible. And that's, in a sense, what that track's doing. The question is, how does visual art do that, and particularly how does public art do that? And I think public visual art challenges the ways in which it's possible to think death, to think the limit, to think the event, and that in itself should be interesting to us. I'm sure most of you know the famine or the hunger memorial in New York. This is the official description of it from the Battery Park City Parks website. That basically, if you're on top of it, what you see is this, which something looks like a kind of Irish meadow. There's somebody taking a picture. And you have this ruined cottage, which actually came from Mayo, came from the artist Brian Toll's partner's family's land, apparently, in Mayo. So you have this kind of wild zone on the top, 76 foot by 175. Memorial designed by artist Brian Toll. It contains stones from each of Ireland's 32 counties, not something Brian Toll originally planned to do, but something which became part of the project as it developed along. And then along the base are bands of text separated by layers of imported Kilkenny limestone. Toll himself is interesting as an artist in that, I mean, this is his own description of himself. He says his sculptures and installations emphasize a formal and iconographic dialogue with history and context. Architecture, site, and technology are recurring themes. Using a variety of media, his work draws on the scale and experience of surroundings, provoking a rereading by cross-wiring reality and fiction. I want to particularly pick up this idea about the relationship of the work to the surroundings, because I think what it'll allow us to do is think this relationship of the event and the frame. Before Brian Toll did the Hunger Memorial in New York, he was doing work like this. This was a work of his that was fairly well noticed at the time, from 1998, piece in a collection called Common Consent, where you're in a gallery space and you have these sort of stone walls and so on. He was part of a number of artists working in, well, in New York, but elsewhere at the time in the 1990s, who on one hand were, you know, recognizing, if you like, the challenge of not just representation but of producing meaning through work, but were unwilling to go down the route of irony. So instead what he turns to are, if you like, materials themselves. So in a sense what you have is this piece, which is about the materiality of the stone. The other feature of this piece that you also find in the Hunger Memorial, however, is this sense of the labyrinth. So you have this kind of double sense of, if you like, the labyrinth and the material, which is one of the conditioning or one of the kind of thematics that runs through his public work. And I think it's a key piece in terms of thinking about how the Hunger Memorial works. There's a detail from that. His more recent work follows this sort of motif. This is a piece that he has. It's in the University of Washington State. I'm in Seattle, called Stronghold. What looks like is actually a model of a stump of a giant redwood made out of cedar boards. If you look, each of those sort of lines that you're seeing there are cedar board set in. What you can't see there is you can actually go in it, and there are seats and things in it. So like the Hunger Memorial, it invites an engagement with different kind of spatial forms, but it also has this relationship to its environment, in that this is the University of Washington's biodiversity building, which is a kind of classic piece of steel and glass modernist architecture. This is a slightly less interesting one, but I threw it in there anyway, in Calgary, called Outflow. It's in a public park, and you have this, in the kind of linear bit of the park, you have this thing that looks like a kind of, you know, riverbed in flood. When you go into the Hunger Memorial, you have this same sense of the materiality of the work, the stones, a kind of, I hate to use the word authenticity, but a sense of materials that are real, but also this sense of traveling into the space. And then as you get down inside, you have these bands here where you have bits of text, which, again, he didn't choose himself. He worked with a number of people choosing these texts so that there's a kind of textual underpinning to the piece. And this is a detail of what you see when you're down inside the Hunger Memorial. In terms of what is going on here, I think the Hunger Memorial is an easy piece of public art to be critical of just from the start. I mean, you can look at it and you see this kind of, Tui Irish cottage in the middle of a downtown Manhattan, and you think, oh yeah, what's that doing there? But the more you start to look at it and think about it, and particularly when you listen to kind of the things that Brian Toll actually says about the work, you realize that the kind of dynamic that's there is more complicated than it looks like on the surface. And one of the things that Toll himself has said about the work is this. This was an interview he gave with the journal Bomb in 2001. He says, the Irish community in this country being the United States, is a group distinct from the people who remained. They share a common heritage, and this is this idea of post-memory. They share a common heritage, but they've evolved into two different peoples. One people continue to experience the landscape on a daily basis, actually using and changing the landscape, building new buildings, new roads. When you look at the top of the memorial, that bit where there's the cottage and the sort of fallow pasture, you think at first, well, okay, he's acting here, he's talking here as if in Ireland we all kind of live in kind of fields and stone cottages. But actually what he's saying is no, that's the part that changes. And because that part of the piece of sculpture is actually living, it does change. Things grow, things die. It actually is dynamic. Whereas the bit that's underneath, he says the other group, and this is the group who would have immigrated to the United States, left at a moment that's frozen in their mind because that's the event. Interestingly enough, he uses that word event, that moment of departure is the event, the before and the after. Their idea of place is of a place that's suspended between these two worlds. Sorry, their departure. It's a collective memory. It's an idea of a place, he says, the monument, that's suspended between these two worlds. It exists as an imaginary thing here, and it exists as a reality there. To bring these two things together is the challenge. And he says, irony is not the solution. Now, this idea of the American landscape, this particular American landscape of downtown Manhattan, being in dialogue, if you like, with the famine landscape, is something that I know a lot of us in this room have worked on in terms of particularly literary texts. And I know, for instance, Lindsay Jansen's PhD thesis finally has made it out, has a great cover on it, and she writes about this. She has a whole section where she's talking about how with Irish-American writers in the period she's looking at, 1871 to 91, the kind of picturesque and pastoral American landscapes kind of recall for a lot of characters in these novels Irish landscapes, but it doesn't quite work, that the famine memory intrudes and the elegiac dimension is lost. And it's that sense of being between here and there, of the landscape never quite belonging anywhere, being suspended between two places. And this is actually the kind of thing that Brian Toll's work does, that when you look at the piece, not just focusing on what's on top of it, but look at the piece as a whole, in its context, in its dialogue with its site, it looks like this. And some of the earliest commentators on it, I think, who really picked up what it was about, and particularly Robin Leidenberg, says that when we look at it from a distance, one might read it as a slice of archetypal Irish landscape, but one cannot escape the incongruity of this precariously cantilevered slope so starkly out of place in New York's busy metropolitan center. This dislocation is not a disruption of the scene, but its very condition writ large, that the cantilevering of the piece, the kind of the sense that it is torn up out of the earth, that it doesn't belong. The sense of not belonging, of it being not at home there, is actually part of what it's about. And Richard Carney picked up on this as well, and his work's very much in dialogue with Robin Leidenberg's, where he says, Toll preserves the gap between now and then, between here and now, enabling both poles to transit back and forth between the everyday reality of New York life and the imaginary place in the minds of those famine immigrants who left behind over a century and a half ago. It's this between contemporary visitors to the site may experience, and he calls this a poetical ethics of memory. Now, I want to think about this a little bit more in a couple of contexts. One of the things that Toll talked about when the piece was being prepared in this interview we gave to Baum magazine in summer 2001 is he talked about how the existing famine memorials, he said, were almost always bronze and almost always represented an emaciated woman and child. And I know we've already been discussing today about how often famine victims are women and children. And of course, that goes back to Margaret Kelleher's work in the 1990s. And the interviewer says, that's horrible, an image of what can never be properly represented. And we're back to the trope of the unrepresentable. And there's a couple of things in his answer here that I want to draw out, but first I'll go back to this idea of the mother and child. He says, that's right, it shouldn't be. Famine is an unbelievably horrible reality. 1 million people perished in the hunger, starved to death, and millions more immigrated. Its subject is land, says Toll. Not only because land is life-sustaining, but the politics of land. And I'm going to come back to that in just a second. If you're looking at the kind of thing he probably has in mind when he's talking about a kind of visual art where we have the representation of the starving mother and child, there's this piece, Robert Shore's memorial in Boston, which was unveiled in 1998. Sebastian Smee, the art critic for the Boston Globe, calls it the most mocked and reviled public sculpture in Boston. There's quite a bit of competition for that title. To some whose history it is, it may have resonance, but as art, he says, it's pure kitsch. I think it's actually worse than kitsch. Kitsch can be fun. There's an argument Judith Butler makes in Mourning and Violets, where she talks about the idea of, you know, like of mourning as substitution. Yeah, and it's just worth reading what she says here. She says, I'm not sure when mourning is successful or when one has fully mourned another human being. Freud changed his mind on the subject, she says. He suggested that successful mourning meant being able to exchange one object for another. And then she goes on to say that this, in some aspects of Freud's writing, this involves incorporation and melancholia. She says, that might be true, but I do not think that successful grieving implies that one has forgotten another person or that something else has come along to take its place. And this is precisely what this monument is about, is a kind of successful grieving, in that what we have here is the sort of famine trio, the mother, the father, the child, heads down. And then over here, we have the kind of successful Irish-Americans of the present looking very jaunty and pleased with themselves and kind of walking by and just kind of casting a sideways glance at them as if to say, well, you know, we put you behind us. We're kind of moving on. We've supplanted you. And even the kind of, you know, the postures of these figures compared to these figures marching along is, to me, this seems to me exactly the sort of thing that Butler's talking about as a kind of, if you like, act of mourning as something in which the mourned are simply supplanted or erased. Carney's reading of Brian Toll's piece of sculpture, however, says that by being out of place, by being perpetually displaced, it doesn't belong in downtown Manhattan, but it also doesn't belong in Ireland, that what is being produced here is the no place of mourning. Yeah? That mourning is not about supplanting the mourned object. And in order to do that, you locate it in a sort of no place. The place of trauma is always haunted, he says, by a no place of mourning, something that can't be erased. The other, of course, famine memorial that's probably in Brian Toll's mind when he talks about the kind of bronze figures is Rowan Gillespie's piece in Dublin, which was again roundly criticized at the time, not least by Fintan O'Toole, largely for the way it was funded, which involved kind of corporate donations. Well, there were going to be corporate donations, but not that many turned up, that were kind of engraved in the path around it. And O'Toole basically, you know, says the intrinsic aspect of the memory of the famine for the dead will be the graciousness of the wealthy 1990s Ireland. I, in some ways, don't think this piece is, in retrospect, is as bad as a lot of people claimed at the time, although there are aspects to criticize in terms of the way it was funded and so on. But again, what works for me with this is the piece that Toll emphasizes about his own works, which is the relationship of the sculptor to the environment. And it's particularly, you know, we have the Irish Financial Services Center right behind it, that it's the dialogue between these two things. In talking about his work, asked, what if the site were ever compromised? Well, it was compromised in 2009 when somebody drove into it by mistake. This is the Famine, the Hunger Memorial in New York. Not on purpose, as far as I know, but if you know where it's located, it wouldn't be that difficult to do, on a dark night with a few jars in you or something. But anyway, this is not what he meant by being compromised. He says, if the site were ever compromised, he said it would occur over the long run. And that's not a question for me to worry about. It's outside my control, which is fine. I've consciously put the onus on all those constituents to maintain the integrity of the project. But then he goes on to say, the Hunger Memorial is something that can go in either direction. It can be neglected, in which case it gets more wild. That it's got this whole horticultural aspect to it that requires, as any of us with a garden know, some level of maintenance. Or I'm dead and the architects are dead and somebody says, it would look nice if we had tulips planted up there. It can go the other direction. It will reflect changing attitudes and cultural shifts. This is one of the oddest things about a memorial project. It's like going into a collector's house and seeing your art hanging over the toilet. It's not going to stay exactly how I imagined it. Well, there's two ways in which this, I think, doesn't stay exactly how he imagined it. And this is where we can start to think about the artwork as event or as something which encapsulates the event and the frame and the relationship between those two things. One goes back to Toll's original point or point from earlier on that the famine at some level is about land. And of course, what happens within six, seven years after the Hunger Memorial is unveiled in New York, is in Ireland, of course, land becomes a real issue and property becomes an issue. And the relationship of how land becomes property becomes highly problematic. At a similar gathering here in Maynooth a few years back, looking at famine work, we looked at the work of Anthony Haughey, who's an artist who dealt with the property crash and the effects of the property crash, and particularly ghost estates. And what struck me afterwards when I was preparing this was how Haughey's work from settlement, these images of kind of ghost estates taken with very long exposure film, that the images of the kind of the ruined cottage-like and the desolate landscape and the sheer incongruity of it echoed Brian Toll's famine memorial in entirely unexpected and unanticipated ways. But that question of how land becomes property, it goes back to Locke's Second Treatise on Government, 1689, where Locke basically argues that land is held in common in a kind of primal state, and it becomes property when somebody annexes their labor to it. And earlier this year, I came across Robert Emmett's copy of Locke's Second Treatise in the library of University of Notre Dame, and we have a very precocious Emmett writing in hand at the bottom here. Says, I can hardly see that mixing labor, which is our right, with something else which is not our right, can make the compound our right until the mixing of them be previously determined. That, in other words, the question of how land becomes property is problematic in Ireland before the famine. And one of the ways in which we can read the famine is that point at which that problematic issue reaches a point of crisis and reaches a point of visibility. Because in many respects, that is precisely what the famine is about, is how land becomes property and how this, in turn, leads to people's deaths. The location of Toll's monument was commented at the time. And this is Simon Schema, somebody who knows a good bit about place and location and space and so on, writing in The New Yorker, where he noted the incongruity of this memorial to famine, particularly the Irish famine, although there's references in the memorial to world hunger as well, kind of looking down the canyons of lower Manhattan to the real, epicenter of global capitalism. One can emerge from this tunnel of obtuseness, gaze north and south at the canyons of capitalism, he says, and marvel at the certainties of the rich. So in some ways, the kind of roller coaster ride of the Irish economy in the years since the memorial was built in 2002, provide us with one of these instances in which that Toll was talked about at the time of not being able to know how the context for the work is going to change. And I'll come back to this in a second. But the other thing that has really focused the idea of the event in contemporary thought for us, and this is Zizek, again, this is the passage I showed you earlier, was the events of 9/11, which from the very beginning were also aestheticized, notoriously by Karlheinz Stockhausen, who rather ill-advisedly told the New York Times on September 30th, 2001, that it was the greatest work of possible the greatest work of art that is possible in the whole cosmos, which was not a thing to say in New York at the time, and he legged it out of there pretty quickly. But I think one of the things that reminds us is that in our contemporary moment, that September 11th, 2001 is very much the event. And when we think about the event in the terms in which I'm talking about the event, it was almost always with some kind of implicit reference back to September 11th, 2001 as the event. The famine memorial is being built when the events of September 11, 2001 happened, and it's opened not long afterwards. It's opened that summer. And this is commented upon in the New York Times. Here's the New York Times from 2002. If you turn around at that vantage point, we're talking about sort of the vantage point from the cottage on the memorial, and you look directly east along Vesey Street, to Ground Zero, or Vesey Street, sorry, you will see one of those accidental harmonies that Mr. Toll could never have planned. And this is this idea of how the artwork is changed by its frame, that the frame of Lower Manhattan that was designed, if you like, around the memorial changed radically on one September morning, any more than it could have planned the breezes that stir the Crofts plantings to life or the sounds of birds and children that spill onto the still strangely vacant site of this memorial. Thoughts of all those dead a century and a half ago lead inevitably to thoughts of those who died only a few months ago, not of starvation, but of something quicker, yet no less cruel. That in a strange way, this becomes, for a period, this is 2002, it becomes a kind of 9/11 memorial as well, simply by virtue of where it's located. Here's Roberta Smith writing in the New York Times as well. This is July 16th, 2002. It says, the work's potential for contemporary resonance may be unusually great. Today's dedication ceremony occurs in a city that saw history change course a short distance away, less than 6 months after the groundbreaking of the memorial on March 15th, 2001. The memorial here she's talking about, of course, is the 9/11 memorial, which was originally designed by Daniel Libeskind. And these are Libeskind's, some of his original sketches for how he imagined 9/11 to be memorialized. And those sketches turn in eventually to this kind of conceptual drawing of what the whole area around what had been the World Trade Center would look like. Now, of course, over time, this became modified in certain ways. That the site today looks more or less like this. This is a Port Authority photo. But you have these two elements that Libeskind originally conceived of are now in place, which are, the footprints of the original Twin Towers, which are there as absences, as vacancies. I'm going to talk in a few more minutes about them. The towers themselves have changed. The kind of materials are similar in that they're these highly reflective materials. But Libeskind's original tower, for instance, even though it was 1,776 feet high, only had, I think, 82 habitable floors and wouldn't have been economically viable. So the architect David Childs basically redesigned the tower we have today. This tower is not Libeskind's original design. But the concept is Libeskind's. And I just want to think about what that means. This is what you have now in the site of the Twin Towers. You have these ponds. And as you come up to them, around the edges, you have the names of people who died in the towers. And you're kind of looking down into these, and there's kind of waterfalls, and the waterfall goes into another waterfall. And it is an incredibly powerful, if you like, site of memory, but also a site of absence. That, here is this, not just this absence, but the water disappears into this. So that if you want to kind of stage absence, create a kind of architectural form for absence, this is how to do it. Now, Libeskind ends up being, I think, the architect for this, largely because of his earlier work on the Jewish Museum in Berlin, which is this building, which is also a piece of architecture that is trying to find a way of remembering, find a way of dealing with, trauma, let's call it, but also of loss. And this is what James Young has called uncanny memorial architecture. And we can think about I think, the World Trade Center site in these terms, but also the Hunger Memorial in terms of this kind of uncanny memorial architecture. He says, it's a memorial architecture that invites us into its seemingly hospitable environs, only to estrange us immediately upon entering. And the Jewish Museum has these kind of strange rooms that kind of get narrower and narrower and narrower, and it's profoundly disorienting as a building, so that it looks like, you know, you're going into a museum, and really what you're going into is a kind of labyrinth, which brings us back to, you know, what Brian Toll in some ways is doing, I think, in his work as well, this idea of not quite being able to read the situation clearly. Is a memory of historical events which never domesticates such events, as Young. And I think this is what Liebskind is also in some ways trying to do with the 9/11 memorial. Never makes us at home with them, never brings us into the reassuring house of redemptory meaning. And I think in some ways this is the key, that it doesn't allow redemption. And this is, you know, goes back to the idea of the event, that the event is irredeemable in some ways. It is to leave such events, and he actually uses the word event, irredeemable yet still memorable, unjustifiable yet still graspable in their causes and effects. Now, that's the sort of thing that I think is going on there in the 9/11 memorial. But it's more complicated than that, because when you stand around those footprints of the original Twin Towers and you have all the names of those who died engraved around the edges, one of the things that strikes me is, and this goes back to Judith Butler, this is Powers of Mourning and Violence, where she says, you know, one of the real key questions in the contemporary moment is what counts as a grievable life? And what we have graven in bronze around the edges of those pools is precisely a statement of what counts as a grievable life. And I think one of the things that contemporary art is now trying to deal with in terms of 9/11 as an event is how do we think around this? So in the Whitney Museum, for instance, at the moment there's a piece showing by the artist Laura Poitras called Astro Noise, which has a number of elements, but one of them I just want to mention because in some ways it addresses precisely the question that Butler raises and I think is in some ways asked of the 9/11 memorial, of Liebskind's 9/11 memorial. You go in this particular piece, you go into a room, it's a room about this size, the room is completely dark, there's a screen more or less this size hanging in the middle of the room, and you're watching a very slowed down film, of which this is a still, of people watching the Twin Towers coming down. So you're standing there watching this in slow motion, and you're watching these people's reactions, and it's all sort of happening in sort of slow motion. And the room's completely dark, and you're aware then that there's other people in the back of the room looking at the back of the screen. So you think, okay, I'll go see what's on the back of the screen. And you go around to the back of the screen, and we have footage of a prisoner being interrogated in Afghanistan in I think it was 2011. So the back of the screen, you know, what constitutes a mournable life is in some ways being shown to us in the conventional narrative on the front of the screen, but when you go to the back of the screen, here's a life that is not mournable, and even the kind of image that she's using here, this kind of night vision shot, is suggesting, well, this is something we don't usually see. So when we're looking at the Hunger Memorial from the top, then, of the World Trade Center, I think what we're looking down into, on one side is Brian Toll's Hunger Memorial, but on the other side, we're looking down into this Daniel Liebskind's memorial for 9/11, which on one hand, we have to confess, is incredibly moving, but on the other hand, I think raises really serious problems about mourning, about memorials that invite us to mourn, and how we think about events as events, as points after which nothing can be thought in the same way. And this also links into the strand I was following earlier about land and property and about the famine in these terms, but also thinking about the hunger memorial in these terms. Because when you're standing on top of number one World Trade Center, you're also conscious, and if you weren't conscious, you're told, that you're standing on top of the most expensive building in the world. By a margin. Cost $3.9 billion to build. I mean, this is an astonishingly expensive building. So here you're looking down into a memorial that is memorializing the most abject poverty imaginable, poverty, you know, that to the point of starvation, and you're looking at it from a building that cost $3.9 billion to build. That's located on some of the most expensive real estate in the world. And you're also very much conscious, and as I say, Libeskind didn't turn out to be the actual architect of One World Trade Center, but is very much the architect of that space around it, that space is presented to you, and you're conscious of it, as a highly charged symbolic space as well, that the height and even the expense of One World Trade Center is a kind of statement. The reflection of the towers is a kind of statement. Number One World Trade Center is precisely 1,776 feet high. High 1776, that it is very much kind of symbolic architecture that you're conscious of standing in. And I think that invites you to kind of read it in a way that you wouldn't read other buildings. And as an Irish person standing up there, and you're conscious of Libeskind, you're conscious of Libeskind's Dublin building, which is the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre, which uses similar kinds of lines, and which, I mean, it's a fine theatre, but in many ways it is, you know, if you wanted a kind of architectural emblem along with our own convention centre on the Quays, of sort of what happened in Ireland during the boom, during the Celtic Tiger, this is very much it. It's this architectural extravagance that, you know, that suffered pretty severe financial difficulties for a number of years, went through name changes, but it's architecturally very similar, and even has this kind of disruptive thing kind of bursting out of the ground in the foreground. And it's hard not to read One World Trade Center as an Irish person without looking through the lens of the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre. So I come back to Žižek and says, in an event, things not only change, but what changes is the very parameter by which we measure the facts of change. Now, we're at a point now where it's not just that we read history in terms of events, these kind of singularities, the word Lyotard uses, these singularities after which nothing is the same, but that the very parameters for thinking about the event has changed, i.e. a turning point changes the entire field in which facts appear. And Žižek asks us to ask this, and this is what I'm going to end with by asking. He says, in kind of late capitalism, and it's hard not to think about turbocharged capitalism when you're standing on top of the most expensive building in the world. In capitalism, where things have to change all the time, says Žižek, to remain the same, the constant search for the new, it is always the event, it is always the turning point. The true event, he says, would have been to transform the very principle of change, to think about what it means to have an event, to have something that changes. And in a sense, that's what I saw from the top of the World Trade Center, was this relationship between the event, let's treat the artwork, and this was playing that piece of music, to think about the artwork as a kind of surrogate event, as something which allows us to think the event, experience the event at some remove, to see the event, but to see the event in its frame. And that the frame in some ways determines the event as event. And that the frame and the event are in a kind of mutually deconstructive relationship. And I think if we start to think about famine historiography and famine art in these terms, and start to resist the temptation to read the famine as event, but to think about the famine in relation to the frames through which we read it as an event, that new ways of thinking about the famine will emerge. And that's what I saw from the top of the World Trade Center. Thanks.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for that. I suppose just as a... I don't mean to be nitpicky, but Libeskind didn't design that memorial. So it's called Reflecting Absence. It's by Michael Arad and Peter Walker.
Yeah.
So it's actually an entirely different... Peter Walker and Michael Arad. So it's not... It wasn't a design of Libeskind's at all. So I suppose in some ways... While the footprints were maintained, and that was part of Libeskind's original architectural design for that complex, he's only responsible for some of the buildings. The memorial itself went through a protracted commissioning and public debate process. And the only one of the main requirements, of course, was the footprints had to be preserved. Yeah. But all of the finalists did kind of variations, in a sense, of that kind of
project. Yeah, I take the point. Yeah, yeah.
So in a sense, some of the Libeskind's parallels may not actually be quite so accurate because the final result of what you see is not his vision.
Yeah. But I think that central, I suppose the central design of the space goes back to Libeskind's original concept of the kind of absence at the center, surrounded by these kind of reflecting buildings. But I mean, I take your point. It's completely different from what he originally suggested.
But I think it's in terms of some of the like the sonic equivalents that you're referencing, because now when you go to those pools and you hear that sort of thundering sound of the water. Mm. Again, that's a Rod and Walker's design. That's not actually, a component of it. So there's other finalists, for example, who didn't have that as part of their eventual design. And someone like James Young, for example, was on the jury for that, along with Maya Lin. So obviously those kind of Holocaust parallels, the reason why it looks the way that it does is quite, I think, specific. Just a thing about, you know, the Hunger Memorial, I suppose, is like a lot of folks know, it's something I've worked on quite a bit as well. What's interesting to me also about that memorial is, as you say, it was under construction at the time of the World Trade Center bombing. Mm. But of course, because of that reason and because of its proximity, there are the actual remains of the World Trade Center that are embedded in the soil of that monument. Yeah, yeah. So the fact that it is a representation of land, it also acquired quite inadvertently this other very deep sort of relic value for Brian as well, who lost friends in the World Trade Center attacks. So in a sense, it has that almost kind of memorial significance that has doubled, I think, as you pointed out. I just wanted to ask you a question in terms of, because you brought in as well this example of the Rowan Gillespie monument at the IFSC, which of course it wasn't designed for that space at all. It was designed, you know, it was a private commission. It wasn't actually paid for by the stones, by underneath the figures that came later. But in terms of this memorial, it's also quite curious because this is a memorial that's funded by Battery Park City Authority, which is an organization that has a high degree of financial autonomy, $5 million project, massive public art project, no controversy. You know, they had a very high-powered committee that was involved with it. How does that kind of perhaps impact upon your interpretation of the piece if we look at it alternatively, not necessarily as simply an artistic expression, but something that was also a demonstration of the sort of power and wealth and capability of the Irish-American an elite in New York at the time.
Yeah, I think that's. I mean, first of all, your point on World Trade. Yeah, no, I didn't want to get into the whole. I mean, that whole commissioning thing that went on forever, I think that's sort of implicit in what I'm trying to argue is that one of the things you cannot but be aware of when you're there is the value of the real estate. And in some ways, having a field lying fallow, you know, in the middle of some of the, you know, on some of the most expensive real estate in the world is a real statement of look, we can do this. It's a kind of, there's a kind of paradoxical wealth to it in a way. You know, it's like kind of any city center park is also a similar sort of statement to say, well, look, in places where people are contesting space so hotly that we have to build vertically, to have this horizontal space with nothing in it, is a real statement of power. And of course, I mean, the whole location of where it is, opposite Ellis Island, all that is there as part of, and a lot of the kind of images, particularly from the, not so much Brian Toll's the images he would have published, but the ones that 1100 Architects published. You kind of, you know, you're looking out, and there's, you know, you're looking out toward Ellis Island in that direction, and it's very much that's part of the narrative. This is the point of arrival. Yeah, yeah. Thanks.
I have a follow-up comment from Emily's and then a question as well. I was reading recently that in spite of what Brian Toll has claimed, the memorial in Battery Park City is actually in relatively poor condition, and Battery Park City was complaining that it's got to spend a lot of money to refurbish it for 2016, in spite of the projections that it would either die a gentle death and go fallow or
get planted with tulips.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So does that sort of change your argument in a sense, knowing that the renovations came much more quickly than was thought of? And my other question is about the Bourdgash Theatre, where you're making the points about capitalism.
Yeah.
At the end of your talk, where that, of course, became a symbol of the crash, austerity, recovery, and there was this brief moment where it might have become a people's theatre if debt negotiations had been handled in a different way, but of course that didn't happen.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you might sort of just elaborate on how that works as a symbol of the crash, recovery, capitalism, and alternatives.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, just on the first one. I mean, I think the idea that the Hunger Memorial is capable of it will respond to contingency, and I thought Brian Toll's comments were really interesting. You know, for somebody doing public sculpture to say, well, look, down the road it could change, and it might become more, it might become decrepit. You know, and in some ways, that's the nature of the work, that the meaning of it will change. So I think that's sort of interesting. With the Bourdgash Energy Theatre, as I suppose as somebody who's interested in kind of theatre architecture in Ireland, I find it, to me, there's a kind of another layer of resonance there, because there before it was built, there was a debate about moving the Abbey. That the current Abbey site, is there, for precisely those sort of reasons of, if you like, memory of place, that, it's the site of the original 1904 Abbey. But, I mean, in terms of a site on which to build a theatre, it's not in a theatre district as such. It's a very cramped space. It's a very difficult thing to fit a theatre on that space. And over the years, there have been a number of designs. I know Valerie Mulvan, the architect Valerie Mulvan, designed the theatre in 1993 that it would have fit on the current Abbey site. But if you recall, there was a debate, I think it was coming up to the centenary of the Abbey in 2004, about moving it. And the site that was proposed was actually where the Bourdgash Energy Theatre ended up. It was going to be in kind of Grand Canal Basin. It was going to be that area. So I always think there's a kind of phantom abbey there somewhere. And then what ends up being built there is not a national theatre at all. And you're right. Then when it was in financial difficulty, it was suggested, well, maybe it becomes a people's theatre. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And now it's back to being, the place, if you want to see Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, that's where you'll see it. Yeah. So, yeah, no, I think there's a lot of resonances in that, even though it's a relatively new building, it means a lot of different things.
Thanks, Chris. I really enjoyed that. I just had a question that's kind of, well, I think it's connected to all what you were talking about, but maybe it's just reiterating what you were saying, but I just wanted a little clarification on it. So you talked about the famine as event, and then what we're actually talking about is death, and death as the moment when thought stops.
Mm.
And then I was thinking about that as also death is the moment when thought stops, but also it's the moment when thought begins, because it prompts a certain rethinking of one's life when one thinks about their own death.
Yeah.
And then kind of that fits in with like Butler's ideas that you were talking about with mourning, and how mourning isn't just something that produces like something that's static or fixed or paralyzing, that it's actually a force, which I think is slightly different than what Freud is saying, where it's like fixed and then moving on, but mourning is actually something that prompts a new foundation.
Yeah.
So if then at the end of your talk, when you're talking about famine in terms of frames, like that we can rethink the famine in terms of frames, I was wondering if you see 9/11 or the events of 9/11 and the different kind of death that represented, if how that changes the way that we look at the famine.
And this is, I suppose, why I was kind of juxtaposing these two memorials, if you like, these two pieces of, let's call them visual art, is that I think the ways in which we think about death and memorializing death have been challenged for a lot of artists, for a lot of visual artists in particular, but for a lot of artists by 9/11. It's, how do you memorialize this? What is an adequate response? What is an ethical response? What is an appropriate response? And the whole process that site went through, is still going through, really, to try and determine what is the adequate, the appropriate response.
is in some ways asking some of the same questions. Now, they're not identical events in any, or events, I'm using that word again, but they're not identical in lots of ways. But it opens up those questions in some really interesting ways. And I think, you know, for those of us who look at the famine and think about the famine, it's precisely asking that kind of question about death. You know, and I suppose I'm using death partly to talk about real death, but also that kind of philosophical death, idea of death as if you like, the point beyond which you cannot think, you know, the point beyond which thought is not possible. And that is one of the challenges. How do you think past that? You know, and so I think both, whenever you have death on a public scale, you're suddenly forced to think it. So it's not just thinking one's own death, it's thinking the deaths of others. And that brings in that ethical dimension. That, I'm not sure how coherent that is, but that's...
Well, that's great, thanks.
Yeah. Just wondering about the... I knew people involved, the Committee for the World Trade Center Memorial,
right.
And
yeah, yeah.
The big issue they said was that this is actually a mass grave.
Yeah.
The site is a mass grave, and the famine memorials that we're looking at are pretty displaced from the actual sites where people died or where where there are material remains.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering about, and they seem as connected with migration as death. Mm. So I was wondering if you wanted to say anything about the actual kind of materiality of them in that sense, or the immateriality of them, that the memorials seem to always be references, whereas... this is an actual cemetery, in a way, that's been built on. And I know a lot of the relatives found it quite distasteful that it would be built on at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
So no matter how, you know, reverentially it's treated, the fact that it is still expensive real estate and it cannot be sacrificed as such, even though there's, you know, the bodies of the dead or have been vaporized around there or exist there in some way.
Yeah, no, I mean that's, I suppose that raises the similar questions that we find when we're looking at, you know, questions of, say, famine memorials, and it's the sorts of things that, you know, we're finding now in relation to, you know, graves that are emerging, for instance, behind, you know, things like mother and child homes where there are mass graves. The question is, you know, what do you do with that? And is an aesthetic response appropriate at all? In other words, should this become the site for something that is an aesthetic response, or is it something else? You know, and I think that is, in some ways, that's the real question. You know, that, you know, do you build a memorial there, which is at some level an artwork that you can engage with at that level at which you engage with a work of art, or is that something else entirely? You know, and. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Or does it have a different kind of function, you know? It is something that arises, I think, and, you know, it arises in terms of just a lot of the kind of problematic relationship that the famine produces to the Irish landscape. That, you know, when we read accounts of the famine, I go back to, you know, to say literary accounts, you know, we know people died in fields. We know people died in ditches. We know they died inside roads, that they weren't buried, that there are bodies there. But that, you know, does that mean that the fields are no longer tilled, that there's agriculture stops? It doesn't, but they're still there. And so that problematic issue of, you know, how do you adequately commemorate the dead, you know.
Just as there's an event with a frame around it, the site has no frame.
But yeah, that's right. Yeah, 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 yeah. And I suppose that's what I'm trying to think through, is how do we think through, how do we stop thinking about this as the singular event? You know, that has become, that's the dominant trope through which we've been thinking of the famine. And I think, just to go back to the question of, you know, how does thinking about 9/11 allow us to rethink the famine? That I think 9/11 has challenged us to think about the relationship of the event and the frame, of think about the singular event and what it means to talk about the singular event. And maybe in famine studies, we need to revisit that trope, that paradigm, it's not really a trope, that paradigm as well, of the event. And that's very much.